Okay, folks, we're going to get started. Starting a little bit later than usual, I apologize. I'm Dan Rundy. I'm the Schreyer Chair here at CSIS. It's a pleasure to host Mario Pizzini, who's the director of the OECD Development Center. We're going to be talking about global trends in international development and the implications of a shifting wealth world. We've done a lot of work here at CSIS on middle-income countries and how we think about them. I'm particularly interested in how the United States and other developed countries resets its relationship from a development paradigm to a cooperation paradigm with middle-income countries, to move from a chicken or beef mindset, because this is supply-side development, because various interest groups in the United States are pushing for different sorts of outcomes or activities, as opposed to what would actually be in the in American interest, whether it could be trade. And we looked at this 3 years ago and tracked five countries where the United States had hit the reset button on its relationship with middle-income countries, looking at Costa Rica, looking at Tunisia, this is in the 80s and 90s, looking at one of the Baltic states, looking at South Korea, and looking at, I think the other one was Thailand. But the point is that the world is changing dramatically, and I think Dr. Pizzini will have some very interesting findings for us. And I think it has implications for both the developing world, and especially middle-income countries, but also for developed world countries as well. I mean, I think we need to continue to be thinking about how do we engage middle-income countries? What are the implications of this? What is the implications of this for the Millennium Development Goals? What are the implications of this for the post-Busan Global Partnership as well as what it means for how we partner with especially these middle-income countries. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the floor over to my new friend, Dr. Pizzini. Dr. Pizzini, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Daniel. It's a real pleasure to be with you today, and also to be with our Deputy Secretary General of the OECD, which is leading the work on which we are speaking. Bill Danvers is the Deputy Secretary General. What I will do is to pass very quickly through a series of phenomena we have observed in the last 4 years, and then discuss this very interesting question that are the next step of the analysis. The overall story tells something which is very well summarized in a joke of an American economist specializing in development. He said that there are two people meeting each other, and one says to the other, "Paul, what is going on? It has been 10 years, but you were small, now you are tall, you were fat, now you are thin." And the other says, "Well, you know, my name is not Paul. You have changed so much, even the name." In fact, what I am going to show to you is a series of facts that were there, but for some reason we didn't want to see. So let's start. It goes this way. Okay. Let's start by analyzing a series of things. Is it the right or not? Doubt. Is it the right one?
Is this working?
It moves. It doesn't look like the same that I have here.
Is this working?
Okay.
So we got a last minute, or we maybe got something this
updating
morning or last night. Is this the wrong one? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Why don't you just keep talking?
I
we'll
keep talking, and that's a preferred activity between Italians. So let me start with these two slides that are probably the most important of everything. 5 years ago, a collaborator of mine from Germany comes in the room, and he likes to make this type of questioning. And he said, "Look, we took the average rate of growth of OECD countries, and we multiply it twice. And then we went to see how many countries were capable to do better than the double of the OECD growth." And he says, "How many in the 90s? I didn't know, so he said, "Tell me the number. You seem to know it." And it was 13. And you had usual suspects: China, Chile, some Southeast Asian countries, 13 was a great number. 13 countries in the 90s were capable to do better than the double of the OECD. Yes. Now, then he says, tell me, how many countries in the 2000, in other terms, 2000, 2010? And the answer was 83. In other terms, in the first 10 years of 2000, the world changes geography, and the countries that were emerging, as we used to call them, were many more. This changed a series of perspectives, starting with obviously trade, but also reserves. In a certain sense, we wanted to call it shifting wealth, because it was not just a matter of catching up, it was a matter of a real change in many variables. If you look at this map, now it's the right one, you see this is not the dissemination of communism, obviously. It's something different, and is this great dissemination of growth. Now, you can see that with the adjusted data that the World Bank has produced, we are already in the moment in which the developing countries' economy represent more than the OECD economy, and therefore the change already is in place. You can see the change also under other variables, as I said. For example, in 2009, the first partner of Africa in terms of trade became China. Before was United States. Obviously, in Europe, we like to say that is the 27 country of the European Union that are the best partner of Africa. But if you take countries and not geographical regions, then the result is that nowadays is China that have passed United States. Obviously, this is a generalization. If we look more in detail within the region, there are countries that are growing more than others. I have just, for the sake of information, presented here Africa, and you can see that Africa is in reality the result of a series of Africas. In the North Africa, the rate of growth are 3.1. They are still suffering from the results of the Arab Spring. Then you have in West Africa a catching up of Ivory Coast that allow for a better rate of growth. East Africa is still very strong. South Africa is recuperating after some years in which Africa, in particular South Africa, was struggling. If you look at the country in detail, then you see it is just an example that in many cases, the countries that are having an important growth are countries whose economy is driven by natural resources. Not all. In Africa, Ethiopia, for example, represent a model of development in which you have more than natural resources. Manufacturing is there, textile, as we know, and not only textile, with a certain presence of different actors. In fact, the trade and the relationship with this developing world is much more than China, even if China plays a crucial role. It is also a matter of Brazil, is a matter of South Korea, is a matter of Turkey, is a matter of India. And it's important to say, because these different countries are bringing into the development world different type of skills and relationship. We know about China, raw materials, infrastructure, but when it comes to India, we are dealing of knowledge related to information and communication technology. Brazil has a lot to deal with technology in agriculture and in the green area, and obviously Turkey and South Korea is much more about manufacturing. Now, these different patterns of growth are very interesting and important indeed. We will see that they have also some missed opportunity, but in fact, what we are observing is that this development is there, but there are also some signs in which the emerging countries appear to be a little bit tired. And in fact, here with the black line, we represent the difference in rate of growth in GDP between developing country and OECD country. And as you can see, this difference grew, but now is declining. A phenomena that some have studied carefully, because the question was, are these countries going to converge with the OECD country? Are they going to reach one day in 2050, maybe, the same rate of growth of GDP than the OECD, or the same GDP per capita of OECD country or not? Well, when you look at this table, you can easily see the country that are on the right side under the line are countries that are capable to make it relatively early, with rate of growth that are below 5%.
And when you say early, by 2050?
2050, if they keep rate of growth that are around 5.
Okay.
But the countries that are above the line are countries whose effort in terms of rate of growth to reach the GDP per capita of the OECD country is very strong. We are speaking of 10% rate of growth that obviously are pretty unusual. So are we confronted with a general phenomena which is impressive and witness of a major integration of the economy? Yes. Is this phenomena going to last? Are we going to have shifting wealth continuing? In other terms, the center of gravity of the economy that 50 years ago some economists calculated to be placed more or less in the Azores Islands as the development was in North Atlantic, and nowadays with the same criteria appear to be on the eastern border of Turkey. Is it still going to move farther east toward Asia and in part farther south? Or there are some obstacles in this process of change that prevent this phenomena to happen? What I want to comment now is mainly that there are two major obstacles that many countries are facing. I don't think we can speak of a real middle-income trap, indicated a phenomena that is equal in many middle-income countries, but for sure in many middle-income countries and emerging countries, we are facing similar type of major challenges. Let me start with the first of those challenges, and it has to do for sure with productivity in order to overcome this so-called middle-income trap. Many of the developing countries and the BRICS are nowadays the factories of the world. China is already the most important producer of manufacturing, but it's more than China. Brazil, India, Russia Federation, that appear between the 20 most important producers in manufacturing. Still, despite the fact that a certain accumulation in this sector is present and transformation of society from agriculture toward industry is there, well, these countries are facing major challenges. The accumulation model in which you enlarge your employment base and your productive capacity is facing now the traditional frontier related to technology. How much productivity is capable to grow? Well, in many countries, it's not. In Chile, not only in low middle-income countries, in Chile, productivity is flat, also in Brazil, also in some African, North African countries, and in Southeast Asian countries as well. There are weak indicator to describe this situation, but for sure is very often helpful to look at the expenditures in research and development. And the expenditure in research and development demonstrate that developing countries do not do investment in research. Innovation is a broader phenomenon. Obviously, it doesn't take place only if you invest in researcher. It takes place in interaction between firms, but also in this case, the industrial fabric of this country is weak, and the capacity to sum micro-innovation to micro-innovation and therefore identify some breakthrough is not there. The expenditure in research and development in Latin America are below 1%, very often are 1% of GDP, very often are around 5%. Who is lacking is not only the public sector, is in particular the private sector that is not invested in R&D. In China, just to give an idea, we are around percentage of 1.8 of GDP. In the OECD, as average, we are talking about 2.4. One may say, yes, okay, they are not investing, but they could capture a phenomena that now we, that probably always existed, but that now we are calling global value chains. In other terms, you don't have innovation capacity, but you are capable to attract a train that will bring with it a lot of spillover effects, innovation, and other things. And in fact, what we observe in the world is that the trade in intermediate goods is increasing enormously. What is happening is that in the past, under the same roofs, we have to organize several phases of the process of production to produce the final good. The Model T was done all under the same roof by Mr. Ford. Nowadays, you can specialize in just one of the phases of production that can be done under different roofs, and you will not lose in terms of productivity and competitiveness. Moreover, you can organize these phases in different countries and do carburetor in one place and wheel in another one. Therefore, there is a new opportunity for developing countries, because one thing is when you have to invest in the old process of production, buying all the machine, other is when you have to specialize in one of these phases. Your barrier to entry in business are lower because your investment is lower. So some are thinking developing country may not invest in innovation and in research, but they may invest in attractiveness, attracting pieces of the global value chain. If, in fact, the opportunity to do so are largely increasing. Here we have represented the relationship that existed in 95. Sorry, because the data are late, but we are upgrading them. They are detailed data, so a little bit complex to do. So you see in Southeast Asia what were the relationship in the process of production of manufacturing. At the heart of the process, there was mainly Japan and United States. Already 10 years later, the story was completely changed. China was there. So you may attract phases of the process of production, not only of the traditional multinational companies, but also of new actors such as China. The opportunity grow. You have a reason to do so, because we try now to represent in this graph the value added in the export of a country, in other terms, the connection with the global value chain, and the productivity change. You can see that there is a strong correlation between the two phenomena, or a sufficient correlation. In other terms, the more you are engaged in this global value chain, the more your productivity tends to grow. So you could, by attacking your economy to the train which is passing, gain some spillover in terms of innovation, know how to do things, having capital, having better wages or more employment, through better wages if the company pays taxes, also receive some funds to do investment in other area of the economy. But what is the reality? Are the developing country taking advantage of it? And here, obviously, the most interesting area is Africa, because Southeast Asia for sure is. In part, Latin America has some multinational firms themselves. We are speaking about 500 Latin American multinational firms. But it's Africa. And when we look at the percentage of the global production of intermediary goods done in Africa, we see that from 93, a lot have been done. In 93, only 1.4% of the global production of intermediary goods was done in Africa. Now the percentage has increased, but we are only at 2.2% of the global production of intermediary goods. Now we can understand why from Africa, African Union at first, we are hearing a strong emphasis on productive transformation. A lot of emphasis also on what is called industrial policies. The preoccupation of government is how to make the process of industrialization quicker. And also in part, how to avoid the traditional so-called Dutch disease. Just to recall it, it's not a developing country phenomenon, as the name is stating. It appeared first in Netherlands, and you know the story. When you have natural resources, you export, the rate of exchange grows, the employees in the competitive sector will gain. Also, the pizza deliverers and the other producers of services that are non-tradable can take advantage of it. But the exposed employment in the manufacturing sector will suffer because they lose competitiveness as the rate of exchange or wages are increasing independently from what they produce. So in a certain sense, these societies are becoming more polarized, which is creating a series of problems to government. How to avoid Dutch disease, how to benefit more of the new opportunities that are underway, but it's difficult to grasp. The answer of many of these countries is industrial policies. There is no doubt that in Africa, this is the first point in the agenda of the African institution. Africa Union, United Nations Economic Commission of Africa, many regional institutions have this as the first point. Obviously, we know that there are some problems related with these policies. In themselves, in principle, I don't think we need to have any ideological discussion. There is no sense to discuss if it is good or bad. The point is that many countries are doing it. And therefore, the issue is how can we suggest them to do right things and not wrong things? We know that give indiscriminate subsidies to small firms, create a kind of assistance logic that is not helpful. We know that if the public sector decide where to put big investment, it produces what in my country was called cathedral in the desert. You invest a big thing there, no spillover effect. And we know a series of other things on which I can come back in the discussion for the sake of speed. But the productivity issue, which is a crucial issue, is not the only one. Let me start with a simple example. Again, the same guy that came to see me, one day came to see me with another trick. He said, Mario, in the northern part of Africa, there is a country that for 10 years have 5% of growth. A country that had 3% of deficit, minus 3, which is below the Maastricht agreement that no European country was capable to deal with, including Germany. A country that had a total debt of 42.8% of GDP. Again, something that no European country was capable to reach. Actually, many would like to have that type of performance. A country with total enrollment in primary school and very good enrollment in secondary school. He said, which country is this? Well, this country is Tunisia. Tunisia before the Arab Spring. We are talking of a country that, seen before the Arab Spring, was a beautiful country.
On paper,
On paper, but also in reality, in other terms, this data that I gave to you are real data. The country was performing well. The point is that growth is not all. It is probably a necessary condition, is not sufficient. What happened in that country, and I will describe this, the situation are very different in many countries, but it will give an idea of a general challenge, is that the rate of fertility fell down in the last 40 years, from 7 children for women to 2.1, lower than in France. That the children become, from being the pension of the parents, they become the expectation of the family, the realization of the family. That the family made efforts to send them to the university, efforts that were possible because of the economic development, and many left also extreme poverty, so they could try to make efforts. But then the children went out of school, entered the economy, and they found job only in the informal economy. At this point, it's a frustration for the whole family. You have, in other terms, a tension between an improved situation in which people develop expectation because they have left extreme poverty, but on the other hand, they remain vulnerable. They work mainly in the formal economy. When they retire, they do not have a pension. If somebody got sick in the family or there is a divorce, they fall down in extreme poverty. If the local firms leaves the village, they fall down in extreme poverty. This tension between expectation and vulnerability create frustration. As such, well, we did some studies afterwards. We tried to see the correlation between economic development, between education, and we saw that you can predict what happened in Tunisia, in Thailand, maybe in Brazil, maybe with a student in Chile, maybe in Turkey, if you simply expand the range of indicators and you take into account that there is a social tension that matters a lot. Matters a lot in many countries where the middle classes have developed. In fact, the majority of the middle classes are now and will be in the future in developing country. It depends from the definition, but the phenomena is there. But it matters also in big economy like China, because the process of development that was based on the idea that people leave rural areas to go in cities, and as such they keep low the wages whilst the investment grow quickly, is less and less in place, as is happening in China, what happened before in South Korea, Singapore, and so on. In other terms, social conflict at a certain point for full employment start growing, and that's what we see in China. The conflict are growing, and therefore comes the strong necessity of putting in place a social policy, a policy that deal with this tension, as they are not solved by themselves automatically. So I conclude now by saying that in one end we see in this country a strong interest to change the quality of the model of development, less accumulation of factors to grow and more innovation and technological change, and how to do it. Some say industrial policy, in any case they are doing it. And on the other end, we see that there are some social, serious issues that this country have to address. In both cases, policy matter. And the point is that you need to put in place effective policies. But to do that, you need capacity. Capacity to build a serious administration, capacity to have a good regulation, capacity to practice administrative simplification, and to do many other things. Do they have the resources to do so? And here comes a major point. And the major point is that there is no comparison between the fiscal capacity of OECD countries and the fiscal capacity of developing countries. As you can see from this graph, the red line indicates that over time, the converging countries have improved their fiscal system. Nevertheless, let me give you just an idea. In the OECD, more or less, the taxes on GDP represent 35% of the GDP. In Colombia, we are talking of 14% of the GDP. Even Mexico, which is a member of the OECD, is 12% of the GDP. Now there are changes. Chile, which is a very well considered country, and I think it deserves this reputation, is around 20% of GDP. Now, when you have this type of resources, your capacity to build policy is extremely low. And here you can see an immediate consequence of what I'm saying. Here we represented, for Latin American country, the Gini indicator, which is an indicator of inequalities, the most used, before and after taxes. I would like to suggest that you start reading the graph from the last point, which is the OECD average, excluding Chile and Mexico. As you can see, the red point there is the inequality level before the intervention of the states, taxes and the rest, and the second point is inequality level after taxes and the intervention of the state. Inequalities in OECD country decrease significantly. They are not that much lower at the beginning of the process. So you cannot say that Latin America is for natural and divine decision a country with inequalities. But after the intervention of policy, it varies a lot. In Latin America, practically, it does not vary. One of the reasons is obviously the incapacity of the government to do policy. Another is the incapacity of the policy, of the policymaker, obviously. So there is a strong need to improve the things. I passed very quickly through a series of things. I'm sorry that I was for sure superficial in announcing some of the points, but the sake was to provoke a discussion among us.
Thank you, Dr. Pazin. Let me ask one question that I want to hear from Deputy Secretary General Bill Danvers, and I'm going to just signal to my friends Greg Hicks, who's a visiting fellow here, and I hear from my friend Mayra Addison, who's at the Catholic University of America. I want to hear from both of you about this as well and get your reaction, so give you a time to think about it. But before I hear from the Deputy Secretary General, I have one question for you, which is, okay, this is absolutely fascinating. Based on your last couple of points about if you could expand the data, you can sort of predict some of the social unrest that's happening. Are you in essence implying that from, if I look at that, one of those graphs about China, is there going to be, well, first of all, talk a little bit more about sort of what those indicators are, and then specifically, let me ask you, is China, what does it mean for a country like China?
Yeah. I think that this indicator have a lot of limitation. First of all, it's based only on GDP.
And I was thinking we were going to go into business together and do political risk analysis and make a lot of money if we can figure this out.
Yeah, you're totally right. In fact, last time in Australia, I was in a discussion. There was somebody representing Deloitte from London. And when they consider the political risk in countries, they tend to use a very good indicator that is doing business of the World Bank. But it's completely inappropriate because that is measuring how is the environment for business. The political risk comes from other variables that are not related to it. So there is a lot to do, and if you want, we can study a potential startup in this sector.
I'm going to come back to you about this, actually. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
So specifically, why don't you just, let me just push you just a little bit further on the issue of China. So are we going to see more unrest in China based on what you see in those indicators?
I think that what we are going to see is what is already happening, that China started long ago to understand this picture and to prepare to deal with this picture. As we know, the rate of growth of China are the result of a political decision, which is largely based on the view of the midterm and what are the obstacles that they are facing. Vision that, by the way, is available to everybody. I would suggest strongly to look at this book produced by DRC, Development Research Center of China, and the World Bank on China 2030. That's saying exactly what is said here. In other terms, China is aware that they have this problem, and as such, they cannot keep the pace of growth as it was before because the resources are needed for addressing a series of major challenges that they would not be capable to pass if they don't intervene.
Thank you. So Deputy Secretary General Danvers, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. You had a distinguished career. You were in the Clinton administration at the National Security Council. You were in the Senate for a time, and then you were Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of State before coming to the OECD. So if you put your Team America hat back on, which I always wear, could you just spend a minute just reflecting a little bit on what you see here? If you were sitting back on Capitol Hill, or you were advising the Secretary of State, or if you were at the National Security Council, when you see this, what would be your reaction from sort of an American policymaker's perspective?
Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for the question. I'll be very brief because it's much better to talk to Mario and to others who really are experts in this area. So since I work for the OECD, I sort of have to take an OECD perspective, but since the U.S. is the biggest contributor to the OECD, I think it's okay to talk a little bit about how I see the U.S.'s role. When I first started working on the Capitol Hill and Ronald Reagan had just been elected president, we looked at aid and we looked at development in a very, very different way. And now we look at it much more as part of our ability to engage globally, part of our ability to help America prosperity and help American businesses. In fact, in the Bush administration, the MCC was a reflection of that. And that's really kind of the way we have to begin to look at development, because we're not just sort of, China views itself somewhat as a developing economy still, rightly or wrongly. That's how they view themselves. India does as well. But we're also competing with these so-called developing countries, and we need to begin to take a different point of view, a different approach. MCC is one way of doing it. But we also, what we talk about at the OECD are two things, sort of best practices. And if we offer these best practices to countries beyond the OECD, it helps us, because as they improve, their ability to buy our goods and services improve. And I think that's that's absolutely the essential way to sort of look at both development and engagement. And we need to worry about things like governance, which Mario didn't talk a lot about, because if you've got corruption and you have poor governance, it becomes very, very difficult to engage these countries. And you don't really want to make an investment in a country where you've got 10% off the top just to do business. And so these are the kinds of things that we need to begin to look at a little bit more seriously. And I think we're doing that. And I like to think that MCC is one example of that. That's where we're headed next. But there may be other things that we can do beyond the traditional.
Well, I'm a big fan of the OECD. It's the multilateral institution least known in Washington, and one of the least and most important. And I would say it's a global standard setter, and on issues like corruption, you guys are a world leader, and I think have influenced many countries, including Brazil and the United Kingdom, and have done really great work on this. We just a moment of self-promotion. We did a report on the governance and economic growth nexus. We can send that all to you.
That'd
if you have trouble sleeping at night, you'll have a chance to read it. But I do think I completely agree with you about these issues of corruption and governance. And we're also going to be doing something about state capacity as a bottleneck. We've done some work on strengthening how donors strengthen the procurement capacities of governments, where 20 or 25% of GNP pass through procurement agencies. But this issue at the end that you were talking about state capacity and the capacity of policymakers, is, I think, an incredibly important one, especially for these middle-income countries, and I think ties into your comments, Mr. Danvers.
Just one last quick point. We're doing a lot of work with Ukraine, as you might imagine, and one of the things that they emphasize and all the other, the EU and others that we're working with on this, is absorptive capacity in terms of aid. These are the kinds of things you need to begin to look at, which we didn't always look at in the past. And also, how can the Ukrainians came to us and said, can you help us figure out a way to make use of this aid so that it really actually helps and makes a difference, as opposed to just give it to us and we'll figure it out later. So there's really a whole new approach to aid development and economic engagement.
Great. Thank you. So, Greg, thanks for being here. You're a visiting fellow here at CSIS. You're a foreign service officer. You've served all over the world and have a distinguished track record of doing so. I'd love to hear your perspective on this.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Mr. Pizzini. I really appreciated the depth and breadth of the discussion and the graphs. And I think it illustrates that the world is both more multipolar than any of us have a living memory of. I think no one in the world today has lived in a world as multipolar as this one. And that brings us to the question, point that Mr. Danvers made, Ambassador Danvers made, that the world is more competitive than it has ever been. But I'd also like to flip the switch a little bit, in the sense that we in America also collaborate with all of these countries with whom we are competing. We collaborate in the sense of growing the global economy together through trade and investment. And so this heightens the importance of diplomacy, whether this diplomacy is conducted in multilateral institutions or whether diplomacy is conducted bilaterally. Diplomacy is a conversation. It's the conversation that never ends. And so this means that we in America have to become better diplomats. And so I think I'll stop at that point and pass the baton.
Thanks, Greg. Mayra, thanks for being here. You had a past life at the International Finance Corporation, and you're now your professor at Catholic University teaching development. And you have a Catholic University has a particular approach to development, thinking about both growth, but a broader lens, and I think appropriately reflects this conversation that we've been having.
Yes. Thank you first, Dan, for doing this, for bringing for putting together a forum and people to talk about this. And I brought two students today to listen to this, to your presentation, Mr. Pizzini. And as you were presenting, I was thinking about our approach at Catholic University. We're teaching our next generation to look at development with a different lens, with the lens of an integral approach. And as this, I was looking at those countries moving from blue to red. They moved from blue to red based on a series of numbers and indicators, but we didn't look at how the society moved. And that's what our approach takes into account, that the center of production and the center of society is the person. It's like going to the doctor and the doctor sees you and says, oh, your blood cell count is great, your liver functions are great, but he never asks you, so how do you feel? And we see these countries like the Tunisia, I know particularly very well what happened. It was a liberation of the family, a new president who broke with a lot of the society rules that created liberation of the woman, et cetera, but didn't tackle the basic needs that the woman needed to flourish and that the rest of the society needed to flourish. So, as you progress in your presentation and move from the numbers to, so the numbers tell us they are moving up, but what else is needed is reminded me of the approach that we're trying to teach the next generation. It's not about the numbers only, it's about the whole society.
Let me collect a couple more points. Yeah. My friend Bob Berg and this gentleman here, and then I'll give you a chance to respond.
Thank you, Dan. Two points. One is the relationship between the center and all the now growing think tanks in these countries and what that means. I'm thinking, for instance, of the excellent report on economic transformation at the Africa Center for Economic Transformation just produced and other things that make a kind of difference. But one of my favorite American diplomats, who was an assistant secretary in the Clinton years, had a flawless record all these years except for one huge mistake. He thought he could save budget money if the United States didn't become a member of, or dropped its membership in the center. And it's a terrible mistake. And at the time,
this is the OECD Development Center, right?
At the time, two of us, a professor at Harvard and I, objected. Apparently, that wasn't overwhelming as a constituency at the time. So the question really is, you know, how much would it cost to join? And what are the prospects of being part of this really interesting intellectual center?
They definitely want to hear the answer to that. And if Ambassador Danvers wants to comment on that, what's the price tag for membership? I'd be interested in that. And then we'll give this gentleman a chance to.
We'd love. I have a comment question, very similar. Miguel Schloss, I'm from one country that you invoked several times in your presentation. I'm from Chile. And I have a question very similar to the lady from the Catholic University. I wonder what is the cause and the effect when one looks at all these numbers. And to aspire, as we do in Chile, to become almost an OECD member, we have become, and raise our taxes and do all the same things, I wonder whether we are confusing the effect with the cause with the effect. And we may, in fact, by benchmarking ourselves with OECD countries, become like an OECD country, very lackluster performance over living beyond our means and having a pretty stagnant economy. That is a deep concern. And I wonder to what extent in all these factors, we really are underestimating those things that are more difficult to measure. There are ways of measuring that have to do with governance, with incentive structures in the countries. That factor which is called, for the lack of a better word, the oomph, the will to develop.
That's a technical term, right?
Okay. And the question is, what can one do about it? Look at the countries that have pierced the middle income level to become developed. Singapore, Israel, Finland. And I wonder, there are a number, whether these countries, by having had an existential problem at the early stages, and some of them still have them, have the need and the urge to deal with that more than any other thing. And we don't have it in Chile, and my fear is that, yes, we will stagnate, we will become an OECD country, and we will be lingering on. What do you recommend?
Okay.
What one needs and what one needs to do. What's the policy?
So let's start first with, what's the price tag for membership at the Development Center?
No, that, Manica afterwards.
Okay, Manica.
That's our first about.
Right.
You're throwing some Ginsu knives and.
Right.
I'm very happy of your question because I agree strongly with all of those. First of all, with the consideration of we are in a multipolar now situation. Now, what is the need now in a multipolar world? You said it, more diplomacy in a certain sense. But let's qualify what is diplomacy. I like very much your word. We need a kind of conversational diplomacy, as well as we need what Bill said, dissemination of good standards, so to help those countries. Now, here there is a very... Allow me to be a little bit provocative. I cannot be either than provocative anyhow. But sometimes the dissemination of standards sounds as the Dominican priest that go out in the mission to preach the verb. Nowadays, we are in a situation in which politically that's not the type of communication that you can have with many developing countries, as they perceive themselves in a world where there is not only one trajectory of development, but different one. And therefore are somehow, maybe rightly, also jealous of or their own independent choice to go there.
So we need the Pope Francis model of communication?
No, we need another one. We need another one, I think, that is behind the word conversation that was said there. What is the very nature of the OECD from 52 years on? It is creating a table like this, where the country regularly, every 6 months, meet together to discuss their own experience in specific field of policy. In this context, you have a discussion and a peer pressure, but it's soft pressure, it's not strong pressure. That's a mechanism that works. Why OECD? Because it's not a bank. If you are a bank, first, you don't like multilateral discussion between customers. But moreover, if you are a bank, you have a mechanism of pressure. We don't, which is a limit, but is also an advantage. Now, what I think is crucial in the present situation is exactly the model of the OECD, but applied also with those countries. Second point, multidimensional. You couldn't multi-perspective. We call it multidimensional. And we have decided now to do some multidimensional country review, are called, because we think that the point of departure is not the GDP, is a series of well-being indicators, and obviously the conversational dimension with the country, because not everything can be translated into numbers. And that's the point of departure in our analysis. We start with identifying what are the conditions of living of people, what are the different areas, and the bottleneck are not only on private investment. Very often are related, for example, in gender issue. What is the possibility for women to have access to the ownership of land? When there are social norms that oblige to be married at a certain age with certain people producing a certain amount of children. These are a series of constraints that are equally important than the other. That's where we want to go. We are already doing it. And the mechanism of function of the OECD allow for it because we discuss, we not only measure. One thing is to produce knowledge and then disseminate. Other things is to discuss together and through interaction, produce knowledge which is shared, what we call knowledge sharing that is even in the objective of the G20 development group. Now, for what concern the development center in this picture. Development center has a singular characteristics. OECD was created in 61.
It's an offshoot of the Marshall Plan, right? It was the spin-off, it's the transformation of a coordinating body for the Marshall Plan in Europe.
Exactly.
Right?
Marshall Plan that, by the way, give us a lot of indication on how you have to deal when you are a middle-income country. You need a place where you discuss, you receive also resources and so on. Anyhow, this is another discussion that can come later. The point I want to make is that at that point, a gentleman that was called John Fitzgerald Kennedy said, okay, OECD is fine, but maybe we have to complement also creating a body where both developed and developing countries can sit together with the same voice. And he suggested in the Canadian Assembly the creation of the development center of the OECD. that at present, as we are closer to the dream of John Fisher, we have 42 members, 24 are OECD country, 18 are not OECD country, but full member of the
this
center.
This is development center.
Including in the bureau of the center. And these countries are Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, India, Colombia, Costa Rica, Dominican Republic, Egypt, Morocco, Senegal, Thailand, and Vietnam. The point, therefore, is there they are equal. And that's why they do not raise often the traditional opposition, we are developing country, you are not. Because you have created a comfort zone where they can discuss. It has a cost, but it's a very low cost. Country contribute on a different scale of contribution, which is mainly related with the GDP. Germany pay every year 900,000 euros to be member of the center. And it is decided that the country, even the founder of the center, like United States or Japan, that left in the 90s, if they come back, they have to pay as the first. That's the principle. Now, Chile, yes, I agree. This question of the punch, of the drive, of the leadership, of doesn't matter how do you want to call it, which we call development the majority of the time, and that cannot be reduced to, I like very much the metaphor of the doctor. Tim Bergen, professor in MIT, used to say, asking a country about the GDP is like a patient going to see the doctor and the doctor asks only about the weight. Obviously, I wouldn't like in particular the primary indicator. But in Chile, we have, and in other countries, the issue is elsewhere. Is the momentum, is the animal spirit, is the adhesion of the people to a project. And we cannot limit our analysis only to the traditional economic variables. We need something else. And I think that the phenomena in Chile are not only in Chile. They appear in Turkey, they appear in Thailand, they appear in Brazil, they appear in many other places. They need to be observed. That's why we cannot speak only of being good in regulatory reform and you will succeed. What is more and more required is the idea of development strategies in reality that need to entail many things. I know that is a quick answer, but there is also another aspect that I would like to quote for what concern. It's true that Finland, Turkey, and the Southern European country passed through the middle income trap. In many cases, Thailand was capable to do more than what Chile have done. Chile, with copper, was capable to capitalize on rents and invest in salmon, in forest, and in wine. Finland started from forest and invested in these specific trees that produce mobile phones. And it did better. Turkey and Thailand did it better. Now, probably, this is also an important dimension to consider.
So what's the price tag to join the development?
900,000.
900,000, that's it?
If you act today.
Yeah.
Annual, just today, and we pay
you. It's a special offer that I give to you for the next 2 months.
And so, is it annual? It's an annual fee? Okay. All right. So I know we've got 15 more minutes. I think we got 15 more minutes, and I know they've got something at 11. So I could take maybe two more comments. So this gentleman here had one, and let me just see, is anybody else? And this woman here, I think we need to have a little, these two folks. So please go ahead and self-identify if you would, please.
Sure. My name is Tom Bridle, and I'm a democracy fellow at the USAID DRG Center. And my question is actually very much related to that title, because you talk a lot about the capacity gap in governance, but there's also a political gap. And in many ways, the crises that middle-income countries are facing are as much political crises, where they're unable to organize their political institution, be it, you know, my work is around legislatures, so, you know, is it around, like, how do you organize a parliament to be an effective institution? Dan has done some very good work on this, but I wonder if you could speak to this political crisis as well as the capacity crisis or capacity shortcomings.
If you would just identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm Jennifer Bremer. I've done some consulting with the MENA people in the OECD. My question is really, I mean, I totally, there's no question about the intermediate trade, but to what extent is that to a marker of a country that doesn't have a manufacturing sector, really, and therefore relates to bad governance and all the other logistics and other kinds of things. So is that, what are the policy implications? How do you grow your intermediate trade?
Let me just take those two.
Well, the political crisis, first of all, up to now, OECD concentrated in issues that do not include the political dimension, and I think it was a mistake, or at least up to now, we could work in that condition. This is less and less true. We observe a political crisis, a crisis of representation that appear in many countries, including the OECD country, obviously. And as such, things such as the financing of the political system and the functioning of the political system are more and more on the agenda. In particular, an agenda that tends to go farther than considering democracy just the electoral democracy. And therefore, the question of citizen engagement and how do you relate with the different actors is crucial. Particularly crucial in the case of development, because as we are talking of the need of a policy intervention in the field, including of the manufacturing sector, how do you decide about this intervention? And who are the actors that should be involved is fundamental. When I quoted before the example of the cathedral in the desert in Italy, the major mistake was that the central government decided where to put investment. And this doesn't work because the central government does not have all the knowledge and the information which is required to take the decision. It's indispensable, but it's not the only one in the story. How do you build, therefore, this table in which you will have all the different actors that may have a say in the decision in this respect is fundamental. Now, where do we stand in this direction? There are very interesting examples and experience to be studied. First, in OECD country, I am persuaded that the Marshall Fund experience, as well as the so-called structural funds of the European Union experience, which is 0.3% of the GDP of European country, given in infrastructure expenditures to regions, not to countries, what you call states, to states and not to countries, is a very interesting example, because there the European actors were obliged to figure out a mechanism of relationship with institutions that are not only the national government. So analyzing this experience may matter. There is no doubt that at present in China, in India, in South Africa, and in Brazil, the issue of the relationship with these other actors, other level of government, but also other actors, is on the top of the agenda. Brazil has redefined in part, or would like to redefine, the system of public expenditure in infrastructure because apparently it doesn't work, and we see some consequences related to the investment for the Olympic game and the football game. In China, the financial situation of provinces is preoccupying, and in India, there is always the problem that we are dealing with the continent. So, for sure, this element is very is appearing very strong. My preference goes in the direction I'm talking now, is not to separate the functioning of the political system from the policy decisions that are required. For example, the issue of regional development, urban, rural, and where to locate the public investment is a very good, interesting lens to look at this phenomenon. Now, I'm not sure that I have understood your question, but for reason of hearing, not for the brightness of the... Can you summarize in two, reframe it?
My real question has to do with what do developing countries need to do to be able to expand their integration into global value chains? I mean, what are the main things that they would need to do to develop?
Yeah. It's very difficult to give a one answer that solves all problems, because the different global value chain are different in nature. For example, take the cocoa. The cocoa is a global value chain which is mainly related to the producer. They decide a lot of the things. In that case, what you need to do is to diversify your product and increase the quality control on the raw material itself.
Whilst on the other hand, in same country, the production of fruits very often has to deal with all sailor at the end of the chain that control the market. And therefore, here the problem is, how do you reach the market directly? So a general answer is very difficult to give. For sure, the first step would be to start analyzing what are the real linkages that are related with the investment that comes from abroad, and analyzing if it is sometime worthwhile to invest in attractiveness as it is done now at very high level that do not necessarily provide a return in many countries. So that's the point that we suggest at least as a first, as a starting point in the discussion. For the moment, what we have done is that we have created exactly the policy dialogue we were saying before. We have created a group of 22 countries that meets regularly every 6 months to discuss what they are doing in terms of policy for the global value chain. The original idea came from to President Chinchilla, the president of Costa Rica, for a reason that then appeared on the press. She told me, Mario, I have developed the country thanks to Intel that came here. But what if Intel will leave? Now there are many more countries that are capable to attract. I would like to learn from Malaysia what they are doing and Tunisia what they are doing. In Latin America, she thought there were not interesting examples. I don't know if she is right or not. But then we create this group. And now we are observing what they are doing. I think this is the real first step. Learn from the ongoing experience. As from the theory, it's very difficult to say more under my point of view.
Okay. I think we're going to stop here because I know that there are a number of people who are going to want to chat with Dr. Bazzini bilaterally. I appreciate you all being here, and I want to thank Ambassador Danvers for being here as well, and thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedules to be with us. I think this is absolutely fascinating. Please join me in thanking Dr. Bazzini. No, I appreciate it.